morning. It's Saturday, December 20th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Linda Bland, owner of Cahoots Writing Services in Cambridge, Vermont. Co-author of the nonfiction book Don't Stop at Green Lights, Linda Bland has been the owner and principal of Cahoots Writing Services, a writing, editing, and training services company, for 16 years. She writes feature magazine articles and has edited and proofed books, magazines, and newspapers. She also regularly teaches writing and corporate training courses. In her work with individual clients, Linda writes collaboratively, edits manuscripts in preparation for sale, and assists authors in selling their writing projects. When I spoke to Linda last month, I began by asking her how Cahoots Writing Services came into being.
I was laid off from a very cushy job, very nice job at Hill Associates. It was a well-feathered nest. But they took a downturn. They were very honest with us, completely transparent, that unless they got $250,000 worth of business in the next 2 months, they would have to lay some of us off. But they, you know, I got severance, I got COBRA, and they also paid for career counseling. So I went to a marvelous woman who helped me a great deal, and everything pointed towards being an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. Two of my best friends are entrepreneurs, so I'd always wondered whether I could do that or not. And so I tried it, and it's worked out.
How long did it take to work out?
I put about $10,000 into the business of savings. I could not, I don't think I could work with a loan over my head. Mm-hmm. I had to pay somebody else. And that was over the course of the first year. So I'd just pull out, you know, when I had bills to pay, I'd pull out $1,000 or $2,000 and just pay them and kept. I marketed 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. And you do that 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, you will get some business. And so it finally, you know, took off. At about 5 years, it became self-sustaining.
Okay.
And so it's all referrals. I don't even have a website, I'm ashamed to say. I should have a website. But it's all pretty much word of mouth. I do free talks. So I'll talk to any group, virtually any group, and I do look for those and ask, you know, to come. And so that's a good way that word gets out, and I don't care if there's four people there. It still really works.
Now, how do you define the business's mission?
I help individuals, companies, and organizations, meaning nonprofits, achieve their writing, training, and publishing goals.
Okay.
That's my mission.
And how do you suggest that an individual writer define or identify his or her professional goals? Do you work with people on figuring out what it is that they're looking to accomplish?
Most of them come to me with projects. They certainly learn a lot about writing in that process. And we set deadlines, certainly. So I encourage people to set deadlines, to say, I'm going to send this to three journals, three magazines, three, you know, by the 8 weeks from now. Once they have an idea, then to do the research. I mean, that becomes a much more shortened time interval when you're doing this a lot. But I think it's realistic for somebody starting out when they have what they know is a good idea. They've run it by people, and people have responded to it positively and not questioned it as far as being of interest, then identify, do research, find those publications and do the research for the article and write it.
Mm-hmm.
So we set deadlines like that. You know, we'll have a final draft by this day, and we blow by them all the time, to be honest, my clients and I. But if we don't have them, we'll take forever.
Right.
You know?
Right. And you can always set a secondary deadline and say, you know, we're almost there.
Exactly. Yeah. It'll maybe be 2 weeks late. We don't blow too far by them.
Yeah.
But, you know, life comes up, too, and then you can't meet a deadline.
What trends in the publishing world do you think writers should be particularly aware of in trying to find a home for their work?
Most of the transition now is due to electronic media, and writing or authors or the whole publishing industry is trying very hard not to make the mistake the music industry did, which is to put things online and then you lose control. Mm-hmm. So you want to be very careful who you send your work to. One tip is that many of them won't accept an attachment anyway. They want it in the body of the email. Some others have modified that by saying they will take attachments they have asked for. But I would never send a query as an attachment, mm-hmm. you know, for instance. So copyright is changing, and the laws of copyright are actually changing because of this electronic media. And many of the contracts are very publisher-biased. They will say not only electronic media, but any media of the future, mm-hmm. because no one anticipated that we'd be able to move words around so easily, fly them through the atmosphere. So, I encourage people, if you have a contract with either a magazine or a book contract, that language is just, you know, asking too much. Any media of the future, that they have rights to do anything, you know, with your work. But electronic media, you can negotiate for more money for that electronic media. Books online is just barely getting started, mm-hmm. and Amazon has its little Kindle apparatus, and they try very hard to make that what you buy not copyable. But, you know, once again, if you send your whole manuscript digitally, you are taking some risk.
Sure.
That it'll get in the wrong hands, or, you know, the publishers themselves, a reputable publisher is not going to take the risk of stealing your work. The copyright law is very strong. It is protected the second you write it. You don't have to put copyright or C or anything on things. Most of these people may know this. Most of you may know this. But in fact, in the publishing world, it's a little amateur to put copyright on mm-hmm. or C. So I don't encourage people to do that. But a good publishing house that's reputable is never going to take the risk of stepping outside of their contract with you, mm-hmm. because the judges love to back up the David and Goliath. You are David in that situation, and the judges love to back up the copyright law.
Okay.
For these big publishers who might abuse it. You know, if they ever did, they're going to pay heavily for that.
How does a writer working alone recognize a reputable publisher if it's a smaller house that they maybe have never heard of before? What can they look for to figure out if this is a reputable publisher or not?
National Writers Union has some really good sources. They are confidential. You probably have to be a member. Mm-hmm. It's about $100 a year to be a member of the National Writers Union. But if you're signing book contracts, I think it's a good idea, good investment. It's good insurance. They are part of the United Auto Workers.
Huh.
So you have a cadre of lawyers at your disposal, you know, if there is anything like that. But they also have these lists. They're little black books, you know, really. They have a black book of publishers and agents who they cannot recommend. Another great organization is the Association of Artists' Representatives. Mm-hmm. And its sole purpose for being is to promote ethical standards among agents. You must sell 10 books within a year, which is pretty a lot of books, to get into this organization. And all of their, as I say, their whole reason for being is to uphold ethical standards. So anybody in the AAR, you can be a little bit, certainly more sure that they are going to operate within the standards of the industry.
Mm-hmm. Do you act as an agent for your clients at all?
I did for a while, but it's a lot of telephoning and envelope licking. And, you know, I'd rather write. I'd rather be promoting my own work. It's speculative, of course, completely speculative. The good agents don't ask for any money. They may ask you for telephone bills or copying, but, you know, that's another way to tell. So this is apropos to your last question. Another way to tell is if they ask you for reading fees. This is not as successful an agent.
Okay.
So I would actually stay away from anyone asking for a reading fee because they could make their living doing that, instead of really representing you. And it was a little too speculative. It wasn't fun. I was good at it, but I decided I didn't really want to do it anymore. What I still do is what's called agent for hire. I charge by the hour to review a contract, make recommendations. I will negotiate a contract for clients. Some of them, I've had clients who just came with me with a contract. I never worked on the book itself at all, but they were smart enough to come to me with their contract. The truth about contracts is everything but about two things is negotiable.
Right.
And when it arrives, it is completely in the publisher's favor. They're not stupid. They're just doing business. I don't hold it against them. I've really never had a bad experience with a publisher. They're just doing their job, getting as much as they can for as little as they can. But there's, you know, the one thing, of course, in a contract that's not negotiable is that this is original work. You warranty that this is your writing. And we know plenty of, two or three top-level writers who've gotten in trouble over that contract, or that part of the contract, when they plagiarized other writers and violated copyright. They got in big trouble. The publisher can sue them for that breach of that contract, but of course the author whose writing they stole is also going to sue them. So that's a strong, you won't negotiate that part of the contract. Is this original work? Yes, it is.
Yeah.
But the rest, you know, the advance, the graduate, there's an escalation of compensation that should be negotiated. Putting parts of your book in a magazine, they will always say that they get 90%. Well, it should be 50% goes to you. You shouldn't get 10% of the compensation they get for just selling it to a magazine. They aren't touching it. They're not doing anything.
Right. Now, do you find that publishers balk when authors bring a different set of...
No. They're used to it. Okay. Because there's industry standards.
And they're just expecting that people don't know enough to argue the point.
Well, the reason that writers will see under a publisher's name no unagented materials, the reason for that is that too many times a writer has gotten a contract from a publisher, so thrilled to get it, that they sign it and send it back. Well, that contract, as I've already said, is completely in the publisher's favor. It does not guarantee that the publisher's going to publish that book. Most of them do not guarantee that. Well, the authors then become disillusioned and sue the publisher. They have no ground to stand on, but the publisher has to defend themselves.
Which is expensive.
Which is very expensive. So now you understand why they don't want unagented work. Because it costs, these are called nuisance suits by the publishers. Because there's no ground to stand on. So,
now in that same scenario, if the author had an agent, what would the agent say about the contract you've just described?
Oh, they'd negotiate, you know, almost, as I said, almost everything in there is negotiable.
Well, as far as the publisher has no obligation to publish the work, that's not negotiable.
No, it isn't, usually.
Okay.
Yeah. Because their priorities can change. They can have, I mean, look at this downturn. You can bet that they're having to drop some contracts. And they may send some more compensation to those writers, but, I mean, everything's being hit by this big downturn. So, you know, they will often have a clause in there that they will do their best to publish it within 2 years. This is not the legal language that I'm using here. But you can negotiate that down to 18 months, you know, ask for a year. You might settle at 18 months. Publishing has changed drastically because of our ability to reproduce. And there, as you mentioned about trends, another trend is the ability to produce one book instantly. And that is possible now, and it's going to transform the industry because no inventory. Imagine having no storage. That's terrific for a publisher. And they can try out books more, you know. That will be fascinating to watch.
That actually will probably serve the writer well.
Yes, it will.
Also.
It will. It may get more writers published or tried. and it will save the publishers a lot of money, you know, which we hope will be handed down to writers, not to be doing as much of that. I think there's tremendous potential in electronic books. And I do think that they will take over. You know, the boomer generation is attached to hardcovers. We are emotionally attached. We like to hold them. And we like to read a book. But when you think of a device that is backlit so that your partner in bed, you know, is not having you to have the light on or even a book light, it's backlit, and you're just turning the page with your thumb, and you can change the type size as we boomers age.
Right.
And that's a nice advantage. I think they will be, but...
Are you describing the Kindle specifically, or sort of that whole idea?
E-books. They're called e-books, and it's,
right.
They're not the first. The Kindle is not the first. There's another... An e-book came out.
Have
I forget what they call
it. No,
I haven't, but they're $400.
Yeah, that's...
So that industry is not being smart about that, I don't think. You know, you want to give away razors and sell the razor blades. So they should be dropping the cost on these, and I can't imagine why they're so expensive when telephones, it doesn't have to do much. It's just going to read something,
right.
You know, when you
right.
think you can get a phone for $50, why can't I have, you know, a device like this?
Exactly. Yeah.
So it'll be interesting, for sure.
Who does not need an agent?
Well, I think it's... As I was just mentioning, I think it's important to have someone knowledgeable look through your contract. So either a literary agent or a literary lawyer, attorney. I've certainly had people's contracts go down because they gave it to their personal attorney who doesn't know enough.
Mm.
And or isn't in the industry, doesn't know industry standards, and so they push too hard and the whole thing falls apart because the publisher says, we don't have time for this. We have other books we could publish.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it's so competitive right until you've signed.
Right.
That, unless it's a literary attorney. But you're right. I mean, I think that there's a place, I would always have somebody look through it, but if you have a fairly obscure topic, and a small publisher wants to publish it, then that might be, you know, the time. But I would educate yourself as much as you can, get the books on copyright, look online at what National Writers Union says is a good contract. If you don't feel confident negotiating, find someone who does. You know, most business people negotiate all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's really win-win, you
right.
know. It's getting to the solution that is win-win for both parties.
Right. What about before you get to the contract phase when someone is trying to find a publisher, which can mm-hmm. also be just such a huge task?
Yes.
When would you recommend that somebody pursue an agent first, and when would you recommend that somebody just go and try to approach publishers directly?
I think fiction, very hard to get published in fiction, so an agent would be helpful in that. An obscure subject that's very extremely focused, you know, you might not use one, and children's also, you can approach publishers directly, though children's is by far the most competitive of all genres in my experience and in a lot of people's experience. And I think the reason for that is everybody thinks they can write a children's book because it doesn't have to be as good, and the truth is it has to be better,
mm-hmm.
because children don't have any money. They don't have a credit card. You know, children, you know, below age 12 or so don't have anything. And so you have to please both that child and their parent. It has to be a delightful book for the child to want to hear it every night over and over, and for the parent to want to read it
sure.
over and over.
Yeah.
It needs to cross generations
right.
and be fantastic, like be Dr. Seuss. You know, it's fun to read Dr. Seuss. It's fun to read Harry Potter for
mm-hmm.
both generations, and
mm-hmm.
you know, those are examples of what I mean. It's most competitive.
That's interesting, though, because I had an interview with Rita Murphy a couple mm-hmm. weeks ago, who wrote, her latest is called Bird. She's a young adult author in Vermont, and she does not have an agent.
Mm-hmm.
So you can approach
yes,
those
yeah.
houses.
Yeah, I don't believe Tracy Campbell Pearson uses an agent. I'm not sure of that. She's a children's... yes, you can approach them directly. And once, you know, you have a publisher, generally they will keep publishing your work.
Right. So your recommendation would be once the contract is offered, that's when you seek some advice from someone.
Yeah. Just, you know, you do want to think long term. You'd like to keep being published by that publisher. So this is what negotiation is about. So mm-hmm. you give and take and give and take and until it's satisfying for both of them. And that's my last question to a publisher. Are you satisfied with this? Well, you know, you were a little pushy on that. Okay, I'll give up another 10% on that if you're, you know, going to be comfortable with it.
When might you recommend self-publishing to a client?
When that client has a high level of exposure.
Okay.
The publishers are looking for this. They want somebody with what they call a platform. And I have a client right now who's in front of thousands of people every year. She is giving talks on a business topic, and she's asked to do it all over the U.S. And so the truth about publishing is that if someone else publishes your book, you might make $1 a book. If you publish it yourself, you might make $6 or $7 a book.
Mm-hmm.
So business-wise, and another client, Ron Krupp, who's on Vermont Public Radio, he did Woodchuck's Guide to Gardening, and he came to me with that, and he told me that he had been involved with Recycle North. And I thought, you know, if you can sell Recycle North idea, you can sell anything. I mean, he was in on the ground floor of Recycle North. Then he told me he'd sold 3,500 books for another author, not even his own. And every author is the best salesperson for their book. And so I said...
What was the venue in which he was selling 3,500 books?
He just did it for the guy. You know, it was probably a paid position. I don't know what their deal was.
Yeah.
But he marketed this book for another person to the tune of 3,500 copies, which is a lot of copies.
Sure.
So, you know, when I'm talking $1 a book versus $6 a book, it begins to look a lot more attractive. So he had a contract fall through. And so I suggested, you know, when he told me his history and what he wanted, and he was very attached to his vision of this book, too. He did not want a publisher altering it. And so we put it together. He sold 12,000 copies of that book.
Wow.
And, you know, made a lot more than he would have had someone else published it.
Mm-hmm.
He's had publishers approach him to publish it, but they... You know, why should he do that now? But it's all how you want to spend your time. And it's terribly important for self-publishers to realize that 1,500 books are going to show up in your garage. And they can't stay in your garage because they'll be ruined. You've got to store, you know, all these books. Some places will store them for you and ship you books a box at a time. But Ron liked to drive around New England, visit his friends, and talk people into taking that book. And he would leave it not just in bookstores, but in greenhouses. You know, any little garden place, he could sell it. And I've seen it in country stores, in pharmacies. I laugh every time I see it. He could sell icicles to Eskimos. He talks people into it'll be right at the checkout, you know, sitting there. So it always pleases me, of course, to see it. But it is how he, you know, this is how he wanted to spend his time. But mm-hmm. he drives around with his dog and visits his friends. He also will leave three books with those friends and say, you know, when they run out, will you drive it down to your local bookstore? And they do that for him.
Hmm.
So...
You mentioned in our email exchange before this interview something about the seven parts of a quality nonfiction book proposal.
Mm-hmm.
Can you run through what the seven parts are?
Sure. By far the most important part is a document, 7 to 10 double-spaced pages, called the overview. And it says in the first sentence what this book is about, and it says why this book is important now, who's the author, and who is going to buy this book.
Mm-hmm.
So it answers the question, why should this publisher buy this book instead of all the other books from you? Who the heck are you, and why should anyone care what you have to say? You really have to blow your own horn in this and in the later part. And why should it be bought now? Why is now the time for this book? because they want to ride, they want to be on the crest of the wave all the time. Mm-hmm. If it's too late, if the market is flooded with this kind of book, or if there's none of your kind of book, they won't speculate that much. So people come to me and they say, oh, I found a book a lot like mine. I say, good, perfect. How many did it sell? Because it isn't, your book isn't the same. And if it sold a lot of books, you want to piggyback your book on that other book. And so even in this overview, you might say, this is like this other book. It's really a strong marketing document, and mm-hmm. it answers all those questions. Mm-hmm. If it's done well, they want to look at the rest of that proposal. The next part is called a chapter outline. Mm-hmm. And a lot of writers come to me and their book is not fully developed. A chapter outline is the skeleton for that book. It's a paragraph or two about each chapter, and it shows how that book goes from point A to point B. That it is not just a plain old collection, that even if it is a collection, it matters the order in which you read things, even poetry or short stories. There needs to be thought going into chapters. Why is this poem in this chapter? Why is this short story in this chapter and not the other chapter? So it, you could write the book from that chapter outline.
Okay.
Eventually, because it just shows, you know. And that's the difference between a book and a magazine article. A book really has to go from point A to point B, and now I know something new. Mm-hmm. It might be two or three redeeming messages, mm-hmm. even fiction. This is true of, and we're talking about nonfiction, but you can't settle on it based on a proposal with fiction. But so it's a critical part of this proposal as well. Then there's an author biography, and that is 1 to 2 pages, double-spaced, saying who you are, what you have published before. This is why it's important to get clips or at least magazine published or published in your local newspaper. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter whether you were paid or not, well, not a bit, as long as you're published somewhere. Then your expertise on the subject. And for my sports book, I do 7 sports. You know, at least I can relate. And I've competed in most of them. So then your experience with media. This woman, if we were going to try and sell her book, I'm in front of 7,000 people a year. Publishers love that. So any amount, you know, you want to sound very enthusiastic about promoting your book, this is a partnership, and it's a business partnership, and they expect you to work. You know, will you travel around New England? Will you travel around the U.S.? The promotion of a book is about 6 months long. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. So you might have to give up, you know, if you have a great book, you might have to give up your life a little bit for only about 6 months. So the majority, that's it, fizzles by then. So, but you want to show that, you know, willingness to promote your own book locally, regionally, and nationally. So, and your experience in doing that, are you comfortable in front of 100 people? Are you comfortable in front of 3 people? So any sort of things like this, you know, we could use as a credential. This interview. Then a market survey, you find books like your book, and should only be 8 to 10 of them. Otherwise it looks a little flooded.
Right.
You want the 8 to 10 best ones. If there is a lot out there, then find the 8 to 10 best ones that have sold the best, that are by the biggest publishers. And you write a paragraph about that book, each book, and you have to say what it does. And then you say how yours is different and better. But you don't want to condemn that book at all, because you may approach those very same publishers, and you should. They did a book like yours. That's who you should approach. Right. They know how to market it. They appreciate what you're trying to do. So it's delicate, the market survey. It says how my book is different and how it's better.
But yours was good too.
Exactly, exactly. And then what are called PR materials, but it contains actually 2 things. One would be any media that brought attention to you anytime you were asked an opinion and it was included in a magazine article or that you appeared on television, or it would include those things which add to your credentials. Maybe a list of all the places that you have presented. Mm-hmm. Something like that would be in the PR materials. But you also include in a nonfiction book proposal other media articles about your topic that show that people are thinking about this topic, that they care about it, that they want more information, that they are interested in your angle. And when I send those, I highlight the part that is relevant to that book proposal in the PR materials. Because I send them an article from Time magazine, they might say, yeah, it's on the same topic, but, you know, I'll highlight certain parts of it that I think are relevant. And that's a hassle when you're sending 10 of them. But it's worth it. You know, it saves them time, and they know you've done your homework, and you're trying to save them time.
Right.
Then a sample chapter, and that needs to be 20 pages, because the biggest reason publishers will reject, the most common reason, I should say, is this is a magazine article, not a book.
Mm-hmm.
This is why the chapter outline that I mentioned is critical. It has to show the depth, and the chapter that you send has to show that this is 1/12 of that book. You know, it's a little chapter of 20 double-spaced pages, 5,000 words, somewhere along in there. And once again, it needs to go from point A to point B and be readable. It ought to be your very best writing. We polish those to death. The rest of the book doesn't even have to be as good as that chapter that you send as a sample.
It seems sometimes like people are so willing to put so many years into writing a book, and mm-hmm. then they slapdash it off. And it sounds like they really, really need to invest a lot of time in the proposal or in the query process.
It's a marketing package. And every publisher that, you know, at least gets the ones that I've written is so grateful. They reject them as fast as anybody else's, I would say. But they always comment that it was great to get a professional proposal. We knew what we were considering. So it makes rejection a little easier, too. When you have put your best foot forward and it's just the wrong publisher, you really don't want them to take it because they're not going to be good at promoting it for you. They don't get it, you know. And so
I would think, too, that if they had another reason for rejecting it, for example, something in the works that was similar, mm-hmm. they would still be much more open-minded about your next project because they received something so professional the first time.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
What mistakes do you see fiction writers making that will affect their chances at publication?
Most fiction writers don't realize how much discipline and structure is applied to fiction, to good fiction. So they neglect the craft of writing fiction. Many of them think you can just sit down and write a story. And or that they do not have to, they can write whatever they want and that the facts don't matter. Mm-hmm. And nothing could be further from the truth about the facts. When you read the acknowledgments of fiction writers, they're thanking 100 people minimum. And that's because they've had to go and get the facts. A client of mine set an action scene in Boston and something from the John Hancock Tower was, you know, looking down over here. And he went there and went up to the top and made sure that there was a line of sight to Bunker Hill because it was in his book. And it's funny, though, when you're reading fiction and you find something that's not true, the author loses credibility.
Mm-hmm.
So you never know who's going to read your book. They may be expert in this, or they may live in Boston at Bunker Hill. You can't see the tower from here. It bugs them. So yeah. You really have to do your homework.
And unfortunately, all the accurate details might never go noticed.
Yeah, but and they shouldn't be.
But the mistakes will jump out.
Yeah, probably. Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So, and then fiction, good fiction has one or two redeeming messages, and many writers don't make that decision. What am I trying to say with this? Harry Potter has lots of really neat messages within it, and they're delightfully delivered. So the books that people will go back to. And really people will include whole scenes, whole characters, whole details that are not relevant. So I tell people, if it does not reveal something about that main character that matters later, or move that plot forward, it's gone. Mm-hmm. Whether it's a character or a scene, every last word needs to reveal something about the main character that matters. Not just something frivolous, but something that matters later, or it needs to propel that plot forward, or it's gone.
Do you ever find that your work with fiction writers comes down to helping them get rid of stuff?
A lot, you can imagine.
That yeah. they are in love with and they think it's great, but it doesn't serve the purpose of the book, or it doesn't serve the book well.
Yeah, there's a terrible phrase that as a writer you must be able to murder your children, and as horrifying as that is, it's very true. You know, your favorite paragraph or your favorite character, if it's not revealing something about the main character or moving the plot forward, that right. lovely character you've created is going to have to go in another book or something. I tell people not to dump things, you know. I hang on to it, call them junk files, but, you know, later we might go back and use it or build a whole book around it.
Or it's really interesting to go back later and realize, this isn't that good.
Yes.
I remember this being so brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you do work with an editor, you get better at writing.
I have a friend who's a really talented writer. She's very, very talented, but she's hopeless with spelling and punctuation. What would you recommend to somebody who's in that position? Because the book has to go out looking perfect.
It does.
So should they hire somebody? Is that the...
Well, the truth about that is that publishers do not edit anymore. They don't do it at all. They have so many projects that are all polished and ready to go that the first error of that kind, they'll eliminate a project pretty much based on that. The bigger publishers, especially medium to large publishers, will eliminate on the first cliche, and they will eliminate on the first error if it's on the first page. They will not invest. It's strictly bottom line. They will not invest in cleaning up your manuscript. So, yes, you need to hire an editor and a proofreader even.
Now, those publishers will have copy editors that will catch things later.
Not much.
Really?
You've seen them in books now. You see errors in books.
True.
They're not doing much to them.
Yeah.
They need to be really glowing when they go.
So, do you have any exercises or activities that you turn to or that you advise your clients to turn to when they feel stuck in their writing?
I don't have an exercise, but I think you have to honor the creative process. And I think poets feel this more, that sometimes you feel as if you are the channel. And when I write poetry, it is that way. I feel like it's coming in from the cosmos and it's just traveling through me onto the page. And not everyone's going to have that feeling, but I think it's an experience that indicates how true creativity works. And we have new thoughts when we are least trying to think of them. Mm-hmm. So some of my best thoughts are out running or out walking or in the shower. They're going to come to you at weird times. After this interview, for instance, I'll think of all the things, you know, that I wish I could have shared. And it might be when I'm walking down to get the mail at noon, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think we can prompt that. And instead of getting frustrated when you feel blocked, try to relax, even meditate. A friend of mine's a cartoonist, and he meditates for 20 minutes every morning before working. Mm-hmm. And then he works for 2 hours. He just sketches for 2 hours. After that meditation. So he's really honoring where his creativity comes from, that it comes from within, but that you have to slow down. He has two young boys that get, you know, he's getting them off to school with his wife, just like a lot of people. But that meditation brings him to where he needs to be. It opens that channel from the cosmos for him. So whatever works for you, and exercise works well for me, going for a hike first thing in the morning.
You mentioned setting yourself a prompt. Can you talk a little more about what you meant by that?
Well, I think we do have to focus on things, to think more deeply. I write about nature sometimes. I've had 3 hummingbird experiences. I mean, true interactions with hummingbirds. I held them twice.
Wow.
Of those. And so to think more deeply, not about what God meant or what this meant, but sort of what a privilege it was. You know, twice I saved their lives. They'd just run out of calories. And so I brought them to my feeder and they drank from that feeder. And I opened my hand and they flew away. But what, you know, does that say? I'm hypoglycemic myself. So just kind of playing around with what happened and what relevance does it have to others or to the bigger picture. I'm spiritual but not so religious, so I don't think, why did this happen to me? I don't think in those senses, but I do think, what can I derive from this? So stepping back from your work and thinking more deeply about what maybe you're trying to say, mm-hmm. from your own background, from your own experience, you know, almost in a therapy kind of way. Mm-hmm. So you can sit down with a journal, too, and just free write. This isn't an exercise, but you might discover what's really bothering you and preventing you from writing about this topic because you're thinking about your son or you're thinking about where you're going tomorrow and I haven't packed and, you know, you can be blocked about that. Well, make a list of what you need to bring and then you can
work.
Move on. Yeah, get back to work. Get back to your topic. And I'm very disappointed or chagrined to learn our attention spans are getting shorter. I think we answer emails before I'll look at it. You know, I'll have a stack of 2 inches of manuscript that I need to read and to help people. And I catch myself answering emails instead because I get closure. And we all seek closure. Oh, I did that. You know, I'm done that.
Check it off the list.
Yeah, the list is getting longer all the time. There's always something I can do. I work out of my home, so there's always something I can do here. And I have animals. It's so much more fun to talk to them than to, you know, do my work. So, you know, I think you have to be aware of the way your brain is working and its distractions and trends in your day. And either maybe I need to exercise before I'm going to have to sit still for 3 hours and read that manuscript. And I've figured that out about myself. So figuring some of these preliminary things out or what to do when you're stuck, what works,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's to take a walk or to take your notebook and go sit on a park bench. Take a little pad and go sit on a park bench and try to eliminate everything else that's going on in your mind and say, what am I trying to say?
Well, thank you very much. This was
sure,
great. Thank
sure.
you for talking with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's fun to do.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Linda Bland. Next week, tune in again to hear an interview with Charles Barish, author of Dreams of the Presidents. Right the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. For more information, visit autismsupportdaily.com or call 985-8773. Today's Write the Book prompt is inspired by the interview you heard today. Linda Bland mentioned that she needs to exercise before attacking a manuscript, either her own or one that she's reading for a client. With this in mind, today's prompt is this. If you're feeling stuck or need an idea before getting started with your writing today, go for a walk. Or if you prefer a run or a swim, put on snowshoes or cross-country skis if the snow's too deep for walking. Before striking out, set yourself an assignment. Tell yourself you need an idea or you need to develop that idea you had last week. If a particular scene or piece of dialogue is giving you trouble, suggest to yourself that during the next hour of exercise you'd really like to work out this problem. Write down what you're hoping to accomplish and then leave that written piece of paper behind and go exercise. Don't actively focus on the problem that you have set for yourself. Just let it be there within your awareness as you walk or hike or bike. When you get back, write for at least half an hour and see if you've made progress. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Saturday morning at 9 at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. We're finishing up a little early today. Stay tuned. Hike Petrosian will be in at 10. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.